I can't help but confess that when you put the greatest speeches of all time under the microscope and you begin to evaluate them, they have a couple of things in common. The first is this: the best or among the best speeches that have ever been given were all short. I can't tell you how disheartening that is as a preacher to have to stand up and admit. Lincoln's Gettysburg Address is probably the one that is most known. 272 words, 2.5 minutes is all. The man before him spoke for 2 hours, and then Lincoln spoke for 2.5 minutes. One of the reasons why there are no pictures of Lincoln giving his Gettysburg Address is he was up and down so quickly the photographer couldn't even sharpen his focus enough to get his picture. FDR's speech after Pearl Harbor was a brief speech. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech was not a long speech. President Reagan's speech after the Challenger disaster in 1986 was a brief speech. And yet they all go into the record as some of the most effectual, brief, and to the point speeches. Would you turn in your Bibles, please, to 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And verse 14. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And our text for today is ever so brief, 4 words. 1 Corinthians, the 16th chapter, verse 14 says, "Do everything in love." It's so short we can read it again. Do everything in love. The reluctant convert, the Apostle Paul, the one who was against the church before becoming an advocate for the church, is writing to a community of Christ followers that has not exactly been setting the world on fire in terms of their behavior. Sin in the Corinthian church was running rampant, and his letter to the church basically could be summarized by saying, "Believe and behave," for crying out loud, depending on whether you want to add that last part in. As he nears the conclusion of his letter, it's the last chapter of 1 Corinthians, as he nears the conclusion of his letter, the first of two that he would write to the church at Corinth, he interjects a very short but very powerful phrase that is designed to help them to see what ethic God values the most. And this is what he said: "Do everything in love." The question that we're dealing with today is simply, what does that mean? On the surface, it's pretty simple. Do everything in love. Understood. But we have a propensity for defining things based on our own current reality. And sometimes we misinterpret things as having meaning that was never really intended. So let's dig in a little bit and see exactly what Paul was writing. First of all, in order to really appreciate what he's writing, you need to understand something about this whole concept of doing something in a loving way. It was not traditionally the context for the first century. Paul's writing to a group of Christians in a little town called Corinth, and he says, "Do everything in love." I guarantee you when they received that, they didn't go, "Well, of course, what other way would there be?" No. No, love was not the dominating cultural thing that it is in the 21st century. We have holidays that are devoted to love, where we're reminded about love. That was not the case to the people that Paul was writing to. Jesus actually is the one who introduced this kind of concept of love, and believe it or not, it had never been taught before. When Jesus said, "Little children, I want you to love one another," no one else had ever said that before. And when John, the disciple that Jesus loved, wrote those words, he was writing exactly what Jesus had taught, but the truth was that for the old covenant believer, love was not the essence of their faith. The essence of their faith was obey God's commandments or else. There was a fear that sort of shaped their theology more so than a relational love. The God of the Old Testament was a God of fire and brimstone and standing at the foot of the mountain looking where Moses was getting the Ten Commandments and seeing the lightning and the smoke and the fire. And it wasn't all, whoa, I wish I could be there. Jesus came and to a group of people began to teach this kind of idea of love. So this is not just inherent in all of us. We don't just come by this naturally. This has an introductory point in time in history. And then we turn to perhaps what is most famously known as the love chapter in 1 Corinthians, which is just a few verses away from where we are today in 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians 13 is called the love chapter in the Bible, and in case you're curious, it was not designed to be read at weddings. Now, you've probably never been to a wedding where 1 Corinthians 13 wasn't read in part or the entirety of it. And so we tend to look at 1 Corinthians 13 and everything that it says, and we go, that applies to marriage, that applies to marriage, that applies to marriage. And we think marriage. But that was not what Paul was writing. Paul was saying, I'm trying to show you a better way to live than the way that you've been living before. In fact, he says those words, I show you a better way, and then he goes into ideas about love. There's all sorts of ideas, but like in Ephesians chapter 5, when Paul writes, husbands, love your wives, we go, well, of course, husbands, love your wives. But that was not the norm. No husband had ever been told that he needed to love his wife before the Apostle Paul penned those words. It was not instinctive. And since Jesus is the visible manifestation of God, we need to learn from his example. And this is the most important thing I'm going to tell you today. So if you're only going to listen for 10 seconds, listen to what I'm about to tell you, okay? We're talking about love. But the essence of what I'm trying to communicate today is not for you to do this. Now that sounds strange because I'm talking about love. And yet the essence of what I'm trying to get you to do is not to pattern your lives after the kind of love that we're talking about. Are you with me? No, I hope not, because that's confusing. Most of the time, you know, you expect to hear a preacher preach a sermon and then he goes, now, go do it. Uh-uh. No, I am not telling you to love this way. And here's why. You can't. You absolutely, positively, 100% cannot love the way that I'm going to describe love. The biblical love. You can't do it. I can't do it. It would be like me saying, I'm going to really work hard here at getting you guys to be able to fly. So I'm just going to preach my little heart out, and I'm going to command you to fly, and I'm going to say, okay, now let's all go outside and flap our wings and see how it goes. Abject failure. Because whatever it is that is needed in order to be able to fly, you don't have it, I don't have it, and we can try all day, but all we're going to end up with is sore arms because we can't do it. But wait a minute, you want us to love the same way that God loves? Yep. What I'm presenting to you today is nothing more than a measuring device to be able to determine whether you are loving the way God wants you to. But I'm not calling on you to do it because you can't do it. The goal of this message is not to get you to do something like work hard and love more. It is for you to understand the metric of being able to evaluate whether or not you are. Now, we don't have this anymore. Our home across the parking lot used to be heated with oil. And in the front yard of the parsonage is an oil tank that, like, I think its capacity is somewhere around 900 gallons of oil. And every once in a while, back in the day when we have natural gas now, but we had oil, and you know they would have to come and deliver it and fill it up and everything. And every once in a while, Sherry would say, I think we might be near time to order oil. And I would go out to the shed, and I had this big stick that had numbers on it. And I would go out, and I would get the cap off of the thing that was at ground level, and I would take that stick, and it was like a 10-foot-long piece of wood, and I would lower it down, I would let it stand there for a second, and then I'd pull it back up, and based on where the mark of the oil was, I could tell how many gallons of oil I had left. It was a tool to enable me to see where I stood in terms of oil. But the stick had absolutely no potential to put more oil in the tank. You with me? That's what I'm talking about. What we're going to talk about today is simply evaluating, hey, how are we doing with this love thing? Are we doing everything in love? But here's why I don't want you to go out and try to do it. Because the only way that we are capable of fulfilling this is understanding that it is Christ in me living out his own life, because he's alive, that's going to enable me to do it. So instead of trying harder, it's more like let go and let him love and just go where he leads you to go. So that's a long introduction. Let's jump into the passage. First thing that we need to see is this. Jesus' love is scandalous. Jesus' love is scandalous. It is absolutely insane. It makes absolutely no earthly sense whatsoever. One of my favorite new authors has a cool name. His name is Preston Sprinkle. I love that name. Wish I were named Preston Sprinkle. Preston Sprinkle wrote a book called Charis, which is the Greek word for grace. And in that, he told a story about 20 POWs in a Nazi prisoner of war camp. And one day, they lined up 20 POWs who were assigned to go out and shovel a big hole all day long. That's just all they did. Had no meaning or purpose, but that's what they told them to do. At the end of the day, they came back and they turned in their shovels and they were allowed then to go back to their barracks. But all of a sudden, the Nazi soldier called them all back out and made them line up again and said, one of the shovels is missing. And if we don't have that shovel in the next 30 seconds, I'm going to kill all of you. And there was this long pause because they were waiting for who tried to steal the shovel, who lost the shovel, who was responsible. 15, 20 seconds passed, no response. Finally, one young blonde-haired boy raised his hand and said, it was me, I lost it. And the soldier walked over, pulled out his gun, shot him in the head, killed him. And as he turned around to look at the remainder of the 19 POWs, he glanced to his left. There was the 20th shovel. It had never been lost. But that boy saved 19 lives by giving up his own, even though he had done nothing wrong. That, my friends, is the love of Jesus for you. He didn't deserve to die. He did nothing wrong. But he stepped in front of the bullet that was intended for you. That makes no earthly sense whatsoever. That seems like a waste. It's scandalous. But in his book, Preston Sprinkle says, when we are loving the way that Jesus loves, we will be loving not our friends, but our enemies. Not those who deserve it, but those who don't. Being loved when you know you don't deserve it is one of the most humbling sensations you will ever feel in life. When someone does something for you and you know that you are undeserving, it's humbling. Is your love like that? See what I mean? You're not capable of that kind of love. That doesn't just flow. That's like, oh, piece of cake, no problem. I could love like that. Really? It's not a natural love. It's not instinctive to love that way. Is your love like that? I got to tell you something. I've been in the church virtually all my life. I've been a pastor now for 31 years. I'm in my 32nd year of being a pastor. I have seen thousands of songs proclaiming the love of Jesus. I've preached hundreds and hundreds of sermons, taught Sunday school classes on the love of God. But if you were to put me on the stand in a courtroom situation and make me raise my right hand and put my hand on the Bible, I would have to swear to you, I have not seen that love lived out in the local church setting very often. There is a tremendous outcry in our generation, in the small group generation, for people to be real and people to be transparent. Tell me what's really going on inside. And sometimes people are reluctant to do that, and we say, I just don't understand. I understand. Because the love that I have experienced in 30 years of church life has looked like this. We love you until you blow it. And if you blow it, if you disappoint us, if you let us down, if you make a mistake, we reserve the right to withdraw our love. Now, be real and tell us what's on your heart. Not going to do that. I have had people who have, instead of loving me when I blew it, have treated me horribly. I have been on the receiving end of some vicious behavior from people who, even if I was wrong, should have loved me, but said, you disappointed me. And just to give you, put all my cards on the table, the reality is that what people often do when you disappoint them is they abandon you. If you have abandonment issues, don't become a pastor. Because when you blow it, people will just pick up and go to another church where the minister won't let them down. There is a constant fear of disappointing someone and having them run away and blame you. You know why? Because we haven't figured out how to love perfectly yet. Because perfect love loves the undeserving. Not just the deserving. Perfect love doesn't skedaddle when life gets hard. Perfect love stays. I can't love that way. You can't love that way. Only Jesus can love that way. Secondly, Jesus' love is anchored in truth. Now, when we talk about do everything in love, sometimes the idea is, let's get all syrupy sweet. We just love everybody. Yeah, just love. I love everybody. I've had people say that. I don't need to hear in a sermon about love. I love everybody. Okay. I used to coach Little League. About once a year, somebody would come to me, sometimes mom, sometimes dad, and I'm sure you soccer families never have had to deal with this, but this is what it would sound like. I just don't understand why Johnny doesn't get to play more often. Right at me. So, okay, ma'am, I'm going to be honest with you. Sir, I'm going to be honest with you. Johnny can't hit. Johnny can't catch. Johnny can't even run. I look out in the field and Johnny's picking dandelions out in right field. That's why we don't put him out there, because we actually have a kid who can run, catch, and hit, and we play him instead of Johnny. Maybe Johnny should try something different. I don't know. We've come to associate love with the person who never ruffles feathers, the person who never says a harsh word, who always leaves you feeling good about yourself and your life. But that's not the way Jesus loved. The love of Jesus was not always characterized by words of gentleness. Sometimes Jesus went off. In John chapter 2, we're told that Jesus went into the temple courts and he was so offended by the way that the leaders of the temple were treating his father's house, he went off on them. He got a whip. Jesus whipped people. He overturned their money tables that had money, and the money was flying. He let their animals loose that they were selling. In John chapter 3, Nicodemus came to Jesus at night. Now, Nicodemus is what we would classify as a seeker, and the seeker came to Jesus with sincere questions, and Jesus essentially said to Nicodemus, I can't believe you're so dumb that you haven't figured this out. You, a teacher in Israel, and you haven't figured out what I'm teaching you? What in the world? Jesus, Jesus, tender and mild. Lost people. Certainly Jesus was always loving when it came to lost people, right? So Jesus meets the Samaritan woman at the well. Now, she has quite the checkered past. She's been in 5 different relationships with men. Jesus, don't go there. Treat her lovingly. Talk about the weather, talk about sports, talk about anything, but do not talk about her past. That's a sensitive subject, and she's going to think you're judging her. And Jesus goes, go tell your husband. And she goes, I don't have a husband. He goes, yeah, you're right, you don't have a husband. You got a revolving door there, ma'am. He put his finger right on the most delicate spot that we never would have approached, because his love is anchored in truth. And it's interesting that Paul says in Ephesians 4, speak the truth in love. Love and truth are forever linked. We can't be loving if we're not truthful, and we can't be truthful and not be loving. They have to go together. I don't want a world where no one can come to me and point out that I've missed the mark, that I've blown it. But we got to do that lovingly. If I'm concerned about you and some of the decisions that you're making, and I need to come to you and say, I'm concerned about some of the decisions you're making, I'm allowed to speak truth to you, but I am not allowed to do it in a mean way. I got to do it because I care about you. And there are times when I hold back from having a conversation like that because I don't love the person enough. I just want to correct them. Whew! They made a mistake. Let me point out what they did wrong. And I'm not doing it for the right motivation. I'm just pointing it out because I hate it when they don't get it right. Jesus' love is anchored in truth, and he brings the two together. So when Paul says do everything in love, that must be under the umbrella of truth. There is no room for us to soft soap things in the name of love. What's the loving thing to do is never, ever to lie. I've worked with people sometimes who have relatives in retirement communities, and sometimes they need to share news with a person in a retirement community that's not in good health, and they say, oh, it would be devastating if we told them what happened, and so we're going to lie to them. No, love means truth. Love means truth. Third, Jesus' love went beyond words. 1 John 3:18, love not just in words and speech, but with actions and, there it is, truth. It isn't Jesus' love if I say I love you and yet I remain selfish. It isn't the love of Jesus if it says I love you and I continue to harass you. It isn't the love of Jesus if I say I love you but I'm not willing to sacrifice for you. It isn't the love of Jesus if I say I love you and yet I'm unkind to you. Some of you have heard the words. Some of you have heard the words all your life about the love of Jesus. What you're waiting for, what you're longing for, are the actions to go with it. Husbands, if you tell your wife that you love her one time a year on your anniversary, she's not hearing the words. She's hearing 364 days of non-action. But if she sees love in action 364 days a year, on that day, she will hear your heart. The words are all over the place. But God calls us to action. The single most accurate display of the love of God in action was when Jesus spread out his arms on the cross and died to take my place. We have celebrated that today. He was murdered so that I could go free. But here's the interesting timing of that. According to the Apostle Paul, he did that while we were still enemies. That's what sets it apart, my friend. His timing for showing love and the focus of his love set it apart. You know, when a crisis happens in America, and we've had a steady stream of them the last few years, fires and floods and all sorts of problems that we've had, it's not just the faith communities that respond to the need. People who are agnostic respond to the need when people are in trouble. Even among non-Christians, the response to a national tragedy is usually some outpouring of resources and funds and giving. But what God's love does that makes people sit up and take notice is that it does all that toward its enemies. And we read the story of the Good Samaritan. In fact, it's interesting that a lot of people use that term and they don't even know that it came from the Bible. But in order to understand that story to the fullest, in order to really understand the impact of that story, you've got to understand the Samaritan was that guy's enemy. He hated him. And the Samaritan, that guy, the beat up guy, and the Samaritan was not even usually in the same room with a Jew. People would go out of their way by hundreds of miles to avoid even setting foot in the country of Samaria. People would go from Carlisle to Binghamton, New York, by way of New Jersey, if they could, to avoid going through a Samaritan town. And when Jesus tells the story of the Samaritan demonstrating love and demonstrating love in action, when he gets to the end, I love this part of the story. When he gets to the end, he says, so who was a neighbor to that guy? And the guy that he's talking to can't even say the word Samaritan. He goes, the one who had compassion on him. Can't even bring himself to say the word. That's love. You know, we haven't even started loving the way that God calls us to love until we're loving enemies. But can I tell you something? I am a social media stalker. I don't participate much, but I watch. And it alarms me, the fact that Christians, professing believers, seem to feel that when it comes to social media, that this doesn't apply. And there are enemies, and I'm not talking about people they know, I'm talking about people whose political viewpoints they widely differ from, that they feel the rules are off and they can be mean and unkind and even vicious sometimes in getting their opinion and their position across. I don't see it myself. I don't see that there's any place in life where I am allowed to be unloving, even when it comes to something as volatile as politics. The second thing that makes famous speeches memorable is not just their brevity, but it's also their challenge. The speeches that I referred to earlier are famous because they were all challenging. And here's the challenge of this message. You can't love this way, but Jesus in you can love this way. And what that means is simply that we are positioned to give him the freedom to take us where his love wants to lead us. That's what it means. Galatians 2:20, Christ in you. Paul said in Colossians 1, Christ in you, the hope of glory. I'm crucified with Christ, Galatians 2. What would a loving response be in this situation? What would the loving thing be to do? Well, I may know it, but I still don't have the power to be able to execute it. Jesus, you do. You do. Every day I invite Jesus to take me to that loving place that I don't necessarily want to go to and that I recognize I can't go to. But it's characterized not by how I love the people in my life that are easy to love. It's characterized by how I love my enemies. Sherry is the predominant journey walker in our family. I go out for long walks in the morning. Sherry goes out for long walks by herself, and then she very loyally, very faithfully takes Journey over to the park and does a couple of laps around the park. But I do walk Journey once in a while, and Journey is not an easy dog to walk. Journey is a Yorkie Terrier, and terriers were bred to hunt rats and mice. And so she's got a nose on her that could be part of the FBI. I mean, she is just, you know. But wherever you want to lead Journey, Journey always has a different idea about where she wants to go. And if Journey happens to see another human being or, pray tell, another dog, whoosh! Now, the only salvation is this. We have her on a leash. But she pulls at the leash, because she has an idea of where she wants to go. But as long as I have the leash, I still control how far she can go, where she can go, and with whom she can go. I ever let go of the leash, she would go to places that I don't necessarily want her to go. If you are loving in your own strength, you've got God's love on a leash. And as long as God's love doesn't take you to the wrong place, you're perfectly comfortable saying, here's God's love. I got God's love. I'm doing the loving thing. But God's love, if it really is God's love, is straining at the leash to love difficult people, to love the unlovable, to love your enemies, to sacrifice. And if your love isn't leading you there, the time has come for you to let go of the leash and let God's love take you to places that you are not prepared to go to yourself. Yielding control means that instead of me having a definition of love, I abandon myself to God's definition of love. And I got to tell you, it has taken me to places that were absolutely the opposite of what I expected. I expected that when I would learn to let go of the leash, that God would take me and that I would become this sweet, syrupy person because that's what God's love is like. And I discovered that there are times when God's love has to lead me to places where I say, this far and no farther, I can't let you do that. I've sat in rooms before and I know that I offended people because I was loving them the way God wanted me to love them. And I don't like to offend people, but sometimes love does that. I have loved my children by telling them no to things that they wanted desperately. And I had to be the one that said no. That's love. I have also been called by God to love people that if I would have had a choice in the matter, I would have gone the opposite direction. I don't want to love that person. I don't want to be kind to that person. They have been wrong. They have dealt me wrong, and I don't want to go there. So the question I want to leave with you, the challenging question that you can't fix yourself and that I don't want you to try is this. Focus on his love today and ask him the question, where does your love want to take me today? Where does your love want to take me today? I'm dropping the leash and I'm going to let your love take me into situations and into conversations. It may take you to the care shelter. It may take you into the living room of your unkind neighbor. It may take you to your social media page. It may take you to a foreign country. Where does God's love want to take you today? Pray with me. Jesus, in these next few moments, we give ourselves to hearing your voice. We're going to sing about your love, but our hearts are crying out for you to take control. And whatever you tell us to do today, may our hearts be obedient to you. And may we begin to discover that while we lack the capacity to love your way, you don't. And because you can live out your life in me, I can do the impossible. I can love my enemy. But only through you. Amen. Would you stand as we